revering Buddhas and ancestors, we are one Buddha and one ancestor. So, transmission of light, assembly, we invoke these ancestors. We can see whether, when we hear these stories, do we feel that we're revering them or being confused by them or feeling in awe that there are such records of such strange conversations that have lasted all these centuries, wondering what the value in all that is for us now. It's a mystery. And then we have the bamboo tube of sesshin, into which our curvy snake is placed. So we struggle against those edges of the tube. Feeling a little bit forced sometimes into straightness. We might even, once we're in, now we can't back out. And we can barely move forward without a little bit of twisting. Maybe we see the light at the end of the bamboo. But slowly, maybe we can't even really move at all, but the bamboo is slightly angled, so we're slowly sliding towards the end. We can't get there. The slight angle of the bamboo is all we can rely on. Surrender to this process. And as the periods and days go by, I've been enjoying, I'm not sure if that's the right word, but I'll leave it at that for now. Enjoying some intimacy with the problem maker. Have you met that one? The problem maker. You might find him or her during sesshin, especially as the days go on. If you haven't found him or her yet, that's amazing. So, watching this tendency of mind to make a problem out of our experience. Peaceful room of quiet sitting and a beautiful place and ceremony with friends helping us to continue. Still, the problem maker. Doesn't like to rest for very long. And this is one way of talking about that pivot. The problem maker is the pivot. And the more we get intimate with him, we can question it. Say, actually, who are you, problem maker? And what are you doing? The Buddha, on the Buddha's awakening, he said something like, now I have seen you, problem maker, and you will never make a problem again. I quote the Buddha very loosely. But I understand that was kind of the gist. He understood there's this tendency of the mind to make a problem out of thin air. So it's easy. We do have some, you know, even though it's a nice, beautiful situation, we also have a painful body and long tedium and boredom and feeling of unworthiness and can't quite do this and all kinds of things like that, right, naturally come up. And so all those things are just experience in the moment, but then the problem maker kind of manipulates them a little bit naturally. Like, what would it be like to feel like, I really feel like unworthy and like I'm failing at this endeavor of sesshin, but not make that into a problem? Very difficult. Very fine line. Body and mind continuously churning up experience. And our job is to just experience it. Not make it into more or less. So in case everything is just flowing along and you don't have any problem now, let's hear some stories of the ancestors. If you didn't have a problem before this, see if you can deal with this. Or at the ancestor Furong Daokai, Fuyodokai Daiyosho, basically finished his story. As I said, he was a kind of reviver of Soto Zen. After it had almost died out, we heard a couple ancestors earlier. It had to be kind of like temporarily held by another lineage because it almost died, and then Fuyodokai revived it with his kind of like his devotion to simplicity and focusing on the great matter. He also was known for teaching the Soto tradition of silent illumination. So here's one statement Fuyodokai made, kind of like silent illumination Zazen instruction. if you can awaken to and understand yourself before the empty eon, or like your face before your parents were born, this original face before signs are gotten hold of, then it will be like hundreds or thousands of suns and moons whose radiance is inexhaustible, or like countless sentient beings all at once realizing liberation. This great magnificent display of brightness. But if you still don't understand, it's absolutely necessary that you retreat and come to a halt. They say, there's this great brightness like thousands of suns and moons. And we might feel like, really? I don't see it. And we don't understand this. Then it's absolutely necessary you retreat. Like come to Sesshin, to a halt. You yourself must completely cease. You should be completely at rest. You must be like an incenser in an old abandoned shrine. One thought should last for 10,000 years. And I don't think he means like you should keep obsessing about the same thought for 10,000 years. I think it means like your thoughts kind of like slow down enough that like this one thought of like, goes on for 10,000 years. You should be like a person who doesn't take even a single breath. If you're able to be like this constantly for months and years, then if you don't obtain the fruits of the way, I'm speaking nonsense, and I've been deceiving you all, and I will surely be born trapped in hell. I urge you all not to mistakenly apply your bodies and minds in trying to analyze the distance of the road ahead. That's a good advice for us. Don't wear out our bodies and minds thinking about the rest of Sesshin, or how we could ever realize such a brightness sometime in the distant future. This is like definitely exhausting and pointless. Do not rely on an intermittent approach. It's necessary that you put your strength into it. No one else can do it for you. Great diligence. And it is indeed inspiring to sit Sesshin here with you all. I often marvel every time we do it that we're doing it. in this world of lots of stuff happening, we can actually like stop like this, whatever struggles we might be going through, that we're actually doing it. It feels like a little hall of sanity in a crazy world. So it's a big responsibility for us, and we can also feel encouraged by there's others also somewhere out there. Next week, Jikoji has a Denko-ei Sesshin. Atasahara, maybe right now they're in Sesshin. Emily's about to go to the Green Dragon practice period, do some more Sesshins. And the San Francisco City Center also starting a practice period. So these are our friends all around doing the same work. Especially like now, this time of year, it seems like a bunch of friends are are doing this together. Kathy is at Pasahara now, right? Watching the first leaves fall as the as she walks down the path with the han for later morning zazen rolling down. About now. So, Furong Dao Kai, known for his lofty practice of the way, the governor of the capital city petitioned the emperor to honor him so as to elevate his example. Dao Kai refused the honor, however, on the grounds that when he had left home to seek awakening in his youth, he promised his parents that he would not do anything for gain or honor, but only investigate the way in all sincerity. It was because of this that his parents allowed him to leave home and abandon society. So it was kind of like this, my parents kindly let me not have to take care of the family business so I could just practice zazen on the grounds that, like, you know, if you want to take on the family business, it's okay to make a profit and stuff, but if you're going to leave home to do this, then forget about all that. Just practice the way. So he's, when the emperor tried to honor him, he said, no, I made this promise to my parents and my practice vow. So, as often goes in these stories, the emperor was like, you can't disobey the emperor. I'm trying to give you the imperial purple robe of honor. And if you don't accept it, then you're going to be banished. How ironic, isn't it? You know, it's kind of like, it makes me look bad if you don't receive my robe. So he was banished to some outlying regions of southeast China for going against the imperial will that had later the emperor kind of changed his mind and he was allowed to settle on Mount Furong, Lotus Flower Mountain, or Peony Flower Mountain, where many ascetics had practiced meditation and Buddhist communities had long existed. Here many people came and his teaching was widely known. And then yesterday I read this statement he made about the simplicity of the temple, where they all kept trying to figure ways to, like, simplify their life. So instead of having elaborate tea served to guests, we'll just set up a tea area. People can help themselves. We'll take our rice harvest for this last year, and for this year we're going to use it. We'll just divide it into these 365 portions and use each portion one per day, and doesn't matter if there's a lot of people around or a few people, we'll just use that portion and water it down as we need. So he was known for his lofty conduct and great practice, and yet he was very humble too. As Fuyo Dokai said, please don't use this mountain monk's conduct as an example. I'm ashamed to be the teacher of this monastery. How can I be here wasting the communal goods of the community and quickly forget what the ancestors entrusted me with? when I try to emulate these former ancestors and speak of their sayings and doings, I'm aware that I have no hiding place. So, Foyo Dokai went on like that for a while. And we talked about yesterday something about this, this interesting balance between self-confidence and great humility, because there's other places where Foyo Dokai is so confident in his practice and realization that he he walks out from his teacher covering his ears, for example, and he awakened to this story about not relying on the ancient teachers because it's here right now. So this is, I find interesting, in the same person there can be this sometimes very strong kind of admonishing everyone to wake up to the brightness of 1,000 suns and moons, and sometimes saying, I feel so ashamed to be when I think of these past ancestors, because my practice is so soft and weak in these times. I think it's possible, and quite difficult maybe, but possible to hold both of these together. And watch the problem maker that can say, well, you can't have both of those together, or this kind of shame of my own lack of faith in practice before the Buddha is we make that into a problem and feel like I can't go on, I just gotta quit because I can't do it. So more like there's a lot of work to do, and I vow to just continue endlessly. And sometimes the light's all shining on me. Sometimes I can barely see. So it can be, our experience can be anything. Can we just not grab onto it? So now Keizan, who brings up all these stories of Foyo Dokai, maybe it touches him. Keizan, our great Japanese Soto founder, along with Dogen, kind of co-founder of Soto Zen in Japan, compiling this transmission of light record, inspiring us with his awesome subtlety of the depths of the way. He says, "Now I, Keizan, as a Dharma descendant in the 9th generation after Fuyo Dokai, am prematurely preaching the Dharma of our tradition. After many, many talks, right? Kind of like, I really shouldn't be doing this. I'm prematurely teaching our tradition, actually. My daily activities are poor examples for my successors. My attention to the four kinds of deportment, sitting, standing, walking, lying down, wanders completely. My attention to my posture and the practice wanders completely. How can I face 3 or 4 monks and give a talk of a phrase or even half a phrase? It's shameful, terrible. There's no place to hide from the glances of our ancient ancestors or the penetrating looks of former sages. It's pretty heavy duty, especially for Kazan. Although that is how it is, we should be grateful to be distant descendants of Zen Master Fuyo Dokai and be the family of the school of Eihei Dogen. So, it's natural to feel ashamed and grateful. Or like, under their awesome glance, we can feel very small, but how grateful to be in their family. You should clearly discern the realm of mind and thoroughly take care of it. Without a hair of interest in fame and fortune, and without an atom of pride and conceit, settle your minds and govern your physical actions. Reach what you should reach, penetrate what should be penetrated, and settle the business of your life practice. Do not forget what you've inherited from the former ancestors. Follow in the footsteps of former sages. Meet the former awakened ones eye to eye. And despite the decadence of these final days of the age of the decline of the Dharma, you will be able to see a tiger in the marketplace, or perhaps find gold under your hat. This is my greatest prayer, my earnest hope. So, I think good for modern times too. You know, in this age of decadence, despite such a situation we have, if you keep following the footsteps of the former sages, you will be able to see a tiger in the marketplace, or perhaps find gold under your hat. So I think that I feel that that tension also between perfect just as we are, that I think that heart of Zen is, I would venture to guess, maybe what drew us all to this strange tradition. Is that great open-handed confirmation in Buddha nature, of our Buddha nature, that there is nothing lacking and nothing extra in each of us. It's like very good news. Yeah? This is a great encouragement. So there's that tension, right, between that. And then this, you know, one of the greatest ancestors, two greatest ancestors of Chinese Soto Zen and greatest ancestors of Japanese Soto Zen saying, I am so ashamed at my lack of faith and practice, my distracted conduct and so on. I mean, our challenge is to hold both of these together. I think Kazan is doing that because he does say, you all have this completely. Just the devotion and surrender and relaxing in the bamboo tube and just sliding down. And as I said yesterday, you know, I when I hear Fuyo Dokai, I start feeling that. And then when I hear Katie's on top of that, I feel it even more. That and I feel grateful to be touched by their humility. That in a way, feel like it's being transmitted to me. Maybe you feel like it's being transmitted to you from them. These ancient words coming through in English have an impact on me. Watching the mirror that's holding all of this, trusting that's there in the background, watching the reflections, the messy reflections on the surface, really wanting to work on those reflections. Regretting past actions, and all of that together just continuing. Sometimes I confess I feel right on the edge of like leaping out, and like it's too much, the tension's too great there. I think it might be good for me to actually take up the life of a blueberry farmer. Right after college, during college, I was interested in farming, and I went and spent a summer on a blueberry farm and kind of learned some blueberry farming. And then after, I thought I was getting more and more interested in Zen. I thought, but I was also really interested kind of like self-sufficient farming, staying close to the earth and growing my own food, and felt like both of these ways of life seem draw me. I kind of saw them as two different things. Maybe one of these will be my path. And actually, I think the blueberry farming one seems a little bit more realistic. You can actually, it's a livelihood, you know. And the Zen thing, what do you do with that? So I'm kind of leaning towards the blueberry farm. And then I noticed that actually the problem maker was really active somewhere in here. I was really like, this guy is like out of control. When will he just like give it a break? And like, I had the sense of, if I just go do the blueberry farm thing, I mean, of course I could practice Zen too, but like, this guy is actually really acting up, and I think that's the first that I've got to deal with him. Let's really focus on this spiritual practice part first, and then maybe go back to the blueberry farm. But somewhere along the way, I forgot about the farm. Because I started making friends with the problem maker and learning more about him, but then other, like, you know, cousins of the problem maker came in, and there were like so many people to meet that I still like trying to meet them all.
Thinking about the shame thing.
Yeah.
Can be inherited from generation to generation, right down the line. So, in my worldview, it's not helpful. But if I look at it more as atonement, you know, finding a way to,
yeah,
fully avow,
yeah,
you know, that
By revealing and disclosing our lack of faith and practice before the Buddha, we melt away the roots of the transgression. Yeah.
And just to be aware of it and to watch that.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. For those who weren't here yesterday afternoon, we did talk some about this issue of shame around these ancestors. I think it's really important to remember that if we get into like the kind of like, I am such a failure and unworthy and like and guilty, and my true being is actually fundamentally flawed, all of that, then that's really not what they're talking about. That just corrodes our well-being and practice. So, but it's a fine line, right? I don't think these ancestors, if we look at what they're saying, I don't think they're going that far with it. Because then the next paragraph, they're like, it's like a thousand suns and moons. It's so bright. Let's find it with total devotion. So it's back and forth like that. And another way to look at it may be that it's just whether the self, the kind of small, limited self, kind of usurps these different emotions, both sides. Whether the small self takes and owns this great confidence, this great self-confidence, and we're all total Buddha, this is it. If the self gets a hold of that, then it loses it. And if the self gets a hold of like, I'm so ashamed of my conduct in the face of these ancestors, if the self gets in there, then also it just drags us down, and it's not of any value. So again, like letting these different emotions and inspirations and sense of humility and all of that come through and move us, and let it kind of like move our practice without the small self kind of like taking it on as that's who I am, the unworthy one. It's a little different. But the way that the self does take a hold of it and basically take a hold of almost everything in our experience, that's, I think, is kind of one of those pivot points too. I think these, well, when you hear these words of Fuyo Dokai and Keizan like this, do you feel encouraged or discouraged? Or neither? Or just like, oh, it's just the style of those old Zen people. Yes.
But just, and getting to the, I think another point they're getting at is to just rest in that place. You know, it doesn't have to be a place of tension. It's just to enjoy it. So there are these two truths turning at the same time. And like at the beginning of your talk, when you talked about being in Sashin, and the body and the mind doing what the mind is doing, and can that just be okay? You know, instead of the problem maker, whoever that is, whoever that appears to be showing up and saying this is a problem, to just rest in that also.
To rest in it, and whatever's happening. That's the basic Zazen instruction, is whatever our experience is, just let it be that. Watch it change and new experience arise. Let it pass through without getting overly involved in it, getting a hold of it and blocking it out. And also, I think it's like a almost like an energizer or motivator. I hear their instructions like this, kind of to themselves. Maybe they're trying to spur on the assembly they're talking to, but maybe also to themselves, because that's how I feel it, and I relate to it. I relate to it, and it has some impact. Yeah. Maybe live.
Yeah, I was still playing some kind of pumpkin festival.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Dark Star, yeah?
That's not good.
I was doing yesterday. Last night, one of my jobs is helping out at the symphony, and I was so thinking about the stories and this new conductor is standing on this podium, and he's young, and he's, you know, leading the orchestra. It's just magnificent. And I think these stories as being those teachers directing the direction of the harmonies that show
up. Yeah. Mhm. Yeah. With great energy and expression. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's helpful that you're...
Yeah. Yeah. And the kind of confessional aspect is when I wonder how, if it's encouraging or not, I think for me, I feel like it often is encouraging in a little bit of a bitter way. Not maybe inspiring exactly, but encouraging. It encourages my own. For me, they're it's like a very settling kind of teaching. If I'm feeling kind of exuberant, it's kind of like, oh, okay, come down here, right to this place, and let's look at what we need to do, how we can keep moving this practice forward. So that kind of encouragement. It doesn't make me feel like I was a little bit joking with becoming a blueberry farmer. I mean, maybe. It makes me feel like, let's just continue and with devotion.
A lot of practice pretty much by my own. And a lot of the time I feel myself thinking, am I doing it right? You know, I find myself doubting, and I think, you know, am I doing this right? Am I moving in the right direction? And hearing something like this, especially with the doubts in my mind about my practice, feeling like, you know, I'm not coming here, I'm not going to the Monterey Zen Center, I'm doing most of my practice at home. It makes me feel encouraged, because these great ancestors have had similar doubts about their practice, so it kind of reminds me that, yeah, as I move forward, just gotta keep moving forward, or just keep doing the practice.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I find it encouraging.
Yeah, yeah, there's no end.
Yeah, and these doubts are
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's, I think, an encouraging part too, is like, well, we'll never be like them because they're so great. But actually, we hear the great ones are thinking the same way. So, in that way, we feel kind of connected, I think, too. Yeah, we, Buddhas and ancestors of old, whereas we. And I think I said something yesterday about, well, is this really possible? Can we really like practice as fully and completely as they're speaking about, really letting go totally? And I do feel like there's something in here too about how far do we want to go with it? You know, I think so. We might say, maybe it's another point of tension that we say, well, it's all right here. What do you mean far to go? Because there's just being present in one moment, completely letting go is one moment of Buddha, and you can do that anytime. And then there's like, you know, having it pervade one's entire life in this kind of ceaseless way. And sometimes I feel like I'm doing okay and we're all doing okay, and there's definitely benefits to this practice, we know, or we wouldn't be doing it, right? And then there's maybe more depth that's possible to experience, more freedom, more compassion, more skillful means. And it's kind of like, how far do we want to go? Sometimes I think that for myself when I kind of assess that. And actually, these are my sticking points. And in order to go deeper, I have to shift something like this. And I think it's not going to happen right now. Does that make sense? Kind of, so it's being realistic, and then it's watching those points of like, but if it becomes the total matter of importance, this shift, then it will shift. But like, I have all these other priorities in my life, right? So I think those are really interesting and humbling places to look at, you know. It must be maybe China Cats, do you think? It's one of these dead cover bands, but they're pretty good. China Cats is a local one. Or the Slugs and Roses. Slugs and Roses is another one.
To the park.
So the Fuyo Dokai's closing verse. Now tell me, how can I concisely explain this story? Even without cosmetics, no ugliness shows. We naturally admire the ornaments of lustrous jade bones. And the footnotes say that jade bones, lustrous jade bones in one Chinese dictionary is a phrase that means a person of lofty and pure aims.
Lustrous what kind of bones?
Lustrous jade.
Oh, jade.
Jade bones is a person of lofty and pure aims. So even without cosmetics, no ugliness shows. We naturally admire the ornaments of lustrous jade bones. We naturally admire people like Fuyo Dokai. Yeah, that's Keizan has a little like poetic verse to kind of wrap up each ancestor's story. Next ancestor, Dan Xia Tsuchun, Tanka Shijun Daiyosho. The 46th ancestor was Zen Master Dan Chia Tanka. means red mist. He asked Furong, what is the single phrase that all the sages have transmitted from ancient times? Or what is the one statement that all the sages have transmitted from ancient times? The one phrase since ancient times.
It's a slug in the tube.
A slug in the tube. I know, I can't help. It's like, this music is like in my bones. Any other music I could stay a little bit more focused.
The mariachi totally did not do this to you.
What's that?
The mariachis.
No, it didn't. No, it's just like something else here.
You lined this up as background.
No, I would have set it up during the break. Yeah. It sounds like it's next door, huh? That was a whole event in the park. Yeah. Pumpkin Fest, huh? I guess it's more of Bodhidharma's memorial celebration.
There you go. Dancing around. Living next door, you don't ever see what's going on.
That's true. Yeah, maybe next Kenyan after the talk, I can do that. A little dancing Kenyan. What is the single phrase at all the sages have transmitted from ancient times? If you call it a phrase, you bury the Soto tradition. What's the single phrase that all the sages have transmitted from ancient times? Fuyo said, if you call it a phrase, you bury the Soto tradition. With these words, Tangkashi Jun was greatly awakened. What's the one statement that they've all transmitted from ancient times? What is this one thing? Well, if you call it a phrase or a statement, you bury the lineage. With these words, Tanka was greatly awakened. The master's name was Tsu Chun, or Shijun, Tanka Shijun, which is child of pure heart. He was from the Jia family of Qianqiu. At the age of 19, he left home and was greatly awakened with Furong. At first, he stayed at Mount Shuifeng, later at Mount Tanxia. That's all that we know of his life, apparently. This is a kind of shorter ancestor commentary. Keizan says, his first question was, what is the single phrase that all the sages have transmitted from ancient times? Even though Buddha after Buddha and ancestor after ancestor has changed in appearance, there is without doubt something that has been transmitted, which is without front and back, without up and down, without inside or outside, without self or other. It's called can't you see that it's true? You know what it's called? Non-empty emptiness.
That
That's the light that's being transmitted, non-empty emptiness. And it's the true place to which all must return. There is none who does not possess it fully, or it's inherently complete in everyone, non-empty emptiness.
And you're saying that's the light.
That's the light, yeah. So in many ways, that's the single phrase that's not a phrase that carries along non-empty emptiness. So I appreciate that. Talked a little bit about this at this little dialogue with Father Cyprian the other day, because maybe other spiritual traditions, I think, also have something like this non-empty emptiness, but a lot of Buddhism has just basically empty emptiness. There's even a phrase, non-implicative negation. It's like, this is like the work of Nagarjuna. It's not this, things don't arise from themselves, from another, from both, or from neither, for example. So you negate all the possibilities, and nothing left after that is implied by that negation. Non-implicative negation means like you negate every possible angle on way that anything can be, and that emptiness, that's all you have. It's like the Heart Sutra. It doesn't say no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, but there is, a light as radiant as 100,000 suns and moons. The Heart Sutra doesn't say that, right? It just says there's none of that stuff, and it doesn't leave you anything left. It's a non-implicative negation, or I think we could say empty emptiness. Or as the other day I was saying, there's these traditions of self-emptiness. So like the nature of mind, our nature of mind, from a certain perspective, probably Nagarjuna's perspective, the nature of our mind is empty of everything, including itself. Say, well, there is this actual nature of mind that's, not empty. The very nature of mind is empty of itself, too. Everything dissolves and nothing is left. It doesn't exactly mean, it's still not actually nihilism. It doesn't mean there's nothingness, it just means that nothing positive is being implied. Nothing is being posited. So that's self-emptiness, and then other emptiness is like the nature of mind is empty of everything other than itself, but it's not empty of itself. Everything other than itself is like all the illusions and confusions and delusions that that we think are real, like the problem maker. The nature of mind really is empty of the problem maker. The problem maker really isn't in the nature of our mind. So it's empty of everything other than itself. But it's not empty of itself. Can you follow that a little bit? These terms, self-empty and other-empty. Self-empty means empty. We're talking really kind of about the nature of our true nature. Our true nature is even empty of itself, is one tradition, maybe like Nagarjuna's. And our true nature is empty of everything other than our true nature. But it's not itself missing. Our true nature, we can actually say something about our true nature. Like it's like 1,000 suns and moons of radiant light. And that would be maybe more like the tradition of Asanga and Tathagata Garba and so on.
What view is non-dualistic and the other is dualistic?
Well, I think from the people who teach both those views, that they would both be non-dual. And there's, you know, there's some, this is especially in the Tibetan tradition, there's some debate about those two types of emptiness. Even amongst the greatest teachers, people take both sides of that. Some say our true nature is empty of itself too, because if you leave anything there, it's almost like a little bit of a self to hold on to. So it's empty of itself means like that's actually non-dual, and then the empty of other, people will say it's empty of our true nature is empty of everything other than itself, but it's not exactly that there's something there. It's just implying that it's not just negating. So that our true nature that we are is also non-dual awareness. But it's the awareness side. That's another way to look at it. This empty of self, I mean, it's not even accounting for awareness. Whereas empty of other is like, there's this awareness. There's nothing graspable. It's all empty, and yet we're aware and alive, like Buddha nature.
Does that imply that there's no fixed self? So that the emptiness is due to the fact that nothing ever is the same? Is that what it...
In both cases, no fixed self. But the empty of other, the empty of other tradition, for some people, the empty of self people say that looks a little bit like there is a fixed self, they would say. But the empty of other people say, no, there's no fixed self, but there's not nothing. So... but in both cases, both versions are empty of fixed self. Just one's empty of fixed self, and even this true, our true inconceivable nature, we negate that too. We negate that too. And the empty of other says there's no fixed self or anything else, and this true nature, who we truly are, let's not negate that too quickly. Let's not actually, we don't need to like eliminate this like radiant awareness that actually is our nature. You can maybe say it's a philosophical subtlety, which is why these great teachers in both camps debate each other and say it's more like this, it's more like that. But the empty of other tradition is a little bit more coming from the experiential side. That's, I think, an interesting thing to note, that the empty of other is like, philosophically speaking, you can't refute Nagarjuna. Everything is empty logically, and you know, in terms of logical reasoning, everything is empty, so everyone agrees with that. But the empty of other people say, we agree, and let's honor this inconceivable light of Buddha nature. We're not going to call it a thing, because then Nagarjuna would become upset with us. but we're not just going to do the work of just negating and negating. So I kind of like get sort of a gist of that. So, I would understand that's what's meant by non-empty emptiness. And that's...
like reality kind of dissolving into that emptiness. Everything returns to it and originates from it. That's what it seems like. It's
more
like...
yeah.
The sense I have of it, just that...
the source.
All these ideas we have about our reality just kind of...
yeah.
And the true experience of reality
And there's some kind of, like, we could say, experience or awareness. There's a life. You know.
That, you know, one woman was talking the other day about her coworker having that experience, and there wasn't an identity of other people in the room. That kind of everyone spoke together as one mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of dissolving and.
Yeah. And it's inconceivable too, you know. I think it's all dissolving into, like, you know, one body of being, like in Sesshin too. Maybe when we feel like we're all just chanting together as one body or something like that, and we have that sense, maybe we're starting to, like, tap into that light that's not nothing, right? It's certainly not nothing. I think that's the point, is not emptiness as mere negation. And what's left, it's basically the Buddha nature tradition. That's why I say some people, really strict Nagarjuna middle way followers, would say, like, we don't like the Buddha nature thing, because it sounds like, it sounds too much like there's something there that you can get a hold of. We just want to, like, negate everything that you could possibly get a hold of. That's how you'll really be free. If there's a little bit to get a hold of, if there's a little, tiny little, like, handle on the edge of Buddha nature to get a hold of, then you won't really be able to be totally free. But the Buddha nature people say, there's no handle there. It's inconceivable. It's not something.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's a very, very subtle point, but it could be very easy to, once it's picked up on and grabbed a hold of, it can just very quickly run away.
Yep,
and
yeah.
Expand, and all of a sudden there is an eye, and there is a problem maker.
Yeah.
That becomes reified very quickly.
Yeah. Big reification instantly from a tiny thread of to get a hold of. You pull the thread and the whole ball of yarn rolls out. So yeah, again, a lot could be said about this, and we've talked about before. We're talking about Buddha nature. But I, you know, since I resonate with that type of teaching, and I think Kazon's constantly bringing up these phrases like that, you know, that old person, you know, that one who doesn't wash the dishes, we were talking about yesterday. There's this Tenzo. The Tenzo says, my assistants do all the work. Like, my body and mind is my assistant. But and the teacher says, what do you do? Like, you're a true being, what do you do? And he says, oh, that one I've let go. And we say, like, the one who's not busy, the one who's actually not doing anything, is all different ways of saying this light. It's not nothing. The one who's not busy is not just, it's not obviously not a negation, right? But they're completely not busy. It's not doing anything, but it's radiant suchness. It's hard to talk about. Subtle point for sure. So here, that's what's been transmitted without front and back, without up and down, without inside or outside, without self or other, is called non-empty emptiness. And Kazon, yeah, that's Kazon saying that. There is a footnote here, non-empty emptiness. Fuku no ku. Not empty, empty. One note by a later commentator defines this term as the ultimate or absolute which runs through different individuals. That's a little bit like what you were saying, I think. There's a long history in Buddhism of debate concerning whether there is something which is non-empty. So that's this long debate. Some say that emptiness itself is not empty, a violation of the Madhyamaka position, that's Nagarjuna, that even emptiness is empty. Kazan may simply mean that emptiness must not be construed negatively as a blank or void, an interpretation supported by the context of the term. This emptiness is none other than the realm of the true self, capital S. Danger, danger, the Madhyamaka people say, which Kazan speaks of over and over in these biographies, this true self, this that one. Consequently, it's something positive and grand, not a nihilistic void. It may also be called true emptiness, meaning that though it empties the world of categories, concepts, and structures, which the world does not actually possess, the world remains in its empty actuality as an area of activity. So that's a nice way of saying it, too. You know, I don't... what he says is... true emptiness, meaning that though it empties the world of categories, concepts, and structures, which the world does not actually possess, categories and structures and fixed reference points, the world still remains in its empty actuality as an area of action or activity. When I read that first, I thought, my Madhyamaka side came up and said, I don't know, the world... If we say the world, what kind of world are we talking about here? That's your,
the last class we did.
Five ranks?
Yeah, the ranks.
Mm. Yeah, maybe.
And it kind of reminds me of the fourth one. Mm. Kind of moving into the fifth.
Mm. Yeah, those five ranks are of Dungshan, the five positions or permutations are all about the integration of the relative and the ultimate. And sometimes it's kind of like you see it's all empty, and then there's actually like a magical display of appearance that then that's the realm for bodhisattvas to work in.
Right,
yeah, that is like it is like the fourth rank. Mm-hmm. Yep. And as these five ranks of relative and ultimate integrating move along, as Hakuin, we were looking at Hakuin's commentary, as they kind of evolve, they're also evolving as the bodhisattva path. So at first, it's like a kind of, the first rank is kind of like vast emptiness and kind of a retreat from the world, and then as the ranks move along, it's more and more bodhisattva engagement in the world, till it's like just completely living in the world. But there's no holding on to anything. Yeah, I think it's a good correlation. Please.
The distinction of emptiness being empty,
and
not so empty.
Yeah.
I think, you know, that's not important. I'm absent, my hands and feet and other parts of my body are doing their thing. Mm. That's kind of, well, that's just me being me, you know. I'm thinking of Big Roshi and some other people that, you know, maybe I need to be a little more on top of the checks for that.
Mm. It could get into kind of like a nihilistic excuse for...
Misinterpretation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This whole emptiness area is dangerous in a way for those very reasons that it can undermine wholesome conduct. Shoes outside the door.
Yeah, exactly.
So like Nagarjuna says something like grasping emptiness improperly, and I think he means like in this kind of nihilistic way, is like grabbing a snake by its tail, and the head will turn around and bite you. So,
somewhere else.
So you have to be, very careful, to, emptiness means nothing exists, and there it's a big mess. Whereas I'm very carefully, what is this about here? Is this about not grasping from a small self perspective? And then when we're in accord with that, then ourselves and others are not harmed. Non-empty emptiness is the true place to which all must return. It's inherently complete in everyone. However, many students mistakenly think that it is original non-being or nothingness which cannot be expressed or conceived. So he's continuing with this point. The ancients called such people non-Buddhists who fall into nothingness. So again, emptiness is not nothingness. Even after the lapse of eons as numerous as the sands of the Ganges River, they will never be liberated. Even if you're thorough and meticulous and by all means put an end to all things and make them utterly empty, there is still something that cannot be emptied. So, this is it, right? You put an end to all things and make them utter, or I could say, negate them all, make them utterly empty. Realize the emptiness of everything. There's still something that cannot be emptied. It's not a thing, something in quotes, that cannot be emptied. Investigating carefully, if you once get a peek at it, you will surely be able to get hold of a phrase to express it. Therefore, it's called the single phrase that has been transmitted. At that time, Fudong said, if you call it a phrase, you will really bury the Soto tradition. Truly, this realm cannot be referred to as a phrase. Using words incorrectly is like the bird tracks in the snow. It's therefore said, there are no traces where you conceal your body. So, interesting that he says, if you get a peek at it, then you'll be able to get hold of a phrase to express it. But this is not a phrase. This phrase is not a phrase. Maybe the phrase to express it is just your life. Or maybe it's something like, the sun rises in the morning and the moon sets in the evening.
With a painting.
Yeah. Yeah, this was painted by scholar Wu. Right, is that and that sounds like a phrase. No, it's not a phrase. Right? I think that's it. Yeah, using words incorrectly, meaning like in a grasping way, is like bird tracks in the snow. It leaves traces, and then the hunter can find the bird and catch it down and eat it. It's therefore said, there are no traces where you conceal your body. So we chanted this morning, no trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. Maybe that's that one, the non-empty emptiness, is no trace. But how could no trace continue endlessly? Yeah, it keeps appearing, but not in any way that we can get a hold of it. When bodily awareness utterly ceases and skin, flesh, bones, and marrow are all gone, what traces can remain? If you leave not even a hair of traces, sure enough, it will appear. This is not something others know about. It is not something that's passed on publicly. well, here's the published book. However, when this realm is understood, it is said to be transmitted from mind to mind. This occasion is referred to as the oneness of Lord and Minister, or host and guest, or black and white, relative and ultimate, or the oneness of ultimate and relative. Now, this light is the oneness of the ultimate, where nothing graspable exists, and the relative, where everything appears as a reflection in the mirror. The union of the two truths is suchness where we live. Now tell me briefly, what do you think the form of this realm is? Kazan's verse. The pure wind circles the earth and shakes it up time after time. Pure wind circling the earth, moving the earth. But who can pick it up? Who can pick up this pure wind and show it to you?
Yeah. Well, that was disappointingly short.
Very short.
Considering all we went through in the last couple.
Exactly. Some
those wordy old other answers.
Yeah, exactly. Furong was like 5 or 6 pages, and that was like less than a page. So maybe when Kazan was talking about Furong, he had a lot of green tea before the talk. Just went on and on and on and on.
Somebody got an extra portion of rice. in the group with Father Cyprian, when we talked about this, it made me think of Shohaku Okamura talks about kind of the total dynamic function as the source or Buddha or Buddha nature.
Yeah, and that's Dogen too, right? Like Zenki.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably Zenki.
And I think he was talking to us about this. Did that weekend, thank you. But it made me think that, you know, if we I just like that idea. I'll stop there.
Total dynamic functioning.
Yeah. And didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's another name for this. For that one.
The way of the world, the way of the universe.
Free from all our ideas of it, and yet it's total, including everything. It's dynamic, very active and not passive, and it's functioning every moment, expressing energetically like a flapping fish. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Moving the world.
It's not. It can't be a phrase. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no, you know, a phrase. You know, you begin and you end.
Yep.
You know, this can't be held on.
Mm-hmm. And we're an interesting relationship about words here, too, right? Because, you know, the meaning is not in the words, and yet. Here's like piles and piles of words that are, you know, expressing something. We have to express something while knowing that the true meaning is not actually in the words. Then we can use words freely in a total dynamic way. Yeah, what's the signless sight of awakening? This painting of Guan Yin was painted by Scholar Wu. This is what has signs. What has no signs? And what did he say?
The words escaped me.
The Dalai Lama said kindness, right?
Kindness. Yeah, my religion is kindness. Father Cyprian, he was practicing at Holy Cross, and now he's the abbot at New Kamaldoli, the monastery in Big Sur, and he's got a kind of east-west sangha, he calls it, at connected with the church. And yeah, so we did a kind of like Buddhist-Christian dialogue from a kind of contemplative perspective. Well, I did hear the story one time. Somebody asked Suzuki Roshi something like, you know, what's the heart of Zen practice? Maybe that's a little bit different. What's, you know, the true essence of the Zen practice? And he said, when you put away the brooms after sweeping, put them with the bristles facing up. Because you notice when you put them the other way, they get this sweeping angle and eventually wear down to like nothing. And this keeps it really like horizontal for good sweeping. I appreciate that story. And I, you know, I think they generally try like at Pasahara to do that, but it often gets lost because this is kind of like a kind of a secret oral transmission story that, you know, doesn't always get passed on. So sometimes when I go in this broom closet, I see them all down that way, and I turn them all over. But now you all know. The true secret of Zen practice. Which is, I think, kind of about what we're talking about. Yeah. And, you know, if we fixate on brooms must be that way, and like if your school doesn't put the brooms that way, then like you're not really practicing Zen, then we've lost it all. Why did those guys stop playing when it's now time for cleaning? Separate.
They're being respectful of our meditation.
Shall we go, you and I, while we can, the transitive nightfall of diamonds. We offer any positive energy arising from this assembly to the radiant, non-empty emptiness that lives at the heart of all beings. May they enjoy it fully. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it.